So hello, my name is Alex Steffen, and I'm the editor of worldchanging.com, and I'm here to talk today a little bit about the kinds of tools we're finding out there for making the world a better place. One of the first questions we often get asked when we tell people that we run a site called World Changing is, why do we need to change the world? And the answer is real simple, that we inherited a broken future. We have inherited, due to the previous decisions made by ourselves and our ancestors, a future which is pretty grim. One large symptom of the grimness of that future is climate change. We know from the IPCC report that we got a sneak peek at last month that climate change is here, and it's real, and it's dire, and we're causing it. That we can expect many bad things to happen, including, for example, the possible extinction of polar bears. But it's not just bad things that are going to happen to fuzzy creatures out there. It's going to impact every aspect of our daily lives. The Stern Review, the UK government's official look at climate, found that climate change left unchecked, left unchallenged, could well be the worst economic disaster since the Great Depression. At the same time, we're finding that we've stretched other aspects of natural systems of the planet around us to the breaking point. The WWF Living Planet report, which came out recently, found that one-third of all terrestrial ecosystems have been destroyed since 1970, and that we are now in ecological overshoot. We're using the planet up more quickly than it has the capacity to renew itself. At the same time, a Science magazine survey of the state-of-the-art science about world fisheries found that we have only 50 years left before we have pretty much catastrophic fisheries failure collapses all across the planet. Meanwhile, we also live on a planet full of children. We live on a very young planet with a fast-growing population. And many of our fellow human beings are eager for more prosperity. There are about 4 billion people who are struggling very hard to get out of poverty. They've seen the kind of affluence that we have here in the developed world, and they want something like it. I tend to talk about them being the Baywatch generation, right? Baywatch being the supposedly the most watched television program in human history. They've seen how we live. They want lives that are more prosperous. It's entirely reasonable that they want these things. While at the same time, there's about 1 billion more people who are struggling just to survive. And the lives of those people are becoming increasingly precarious, and we're seeing all through the developing world an increasing dance between human need and ecological decline. And there are many, many people whose lives are in such precarious state that the UN has taken to terming them environmental refugees to be. How would you like that designation? And resources are bluntly running out. It's true of oil, but it's true of a number of other resources as well, minerals and so forth. And we will all likely be involved in more and more conflicts between peoples and nations over what resources remain. Overall, we know that if we continue down the path which we're on now, the consequences are not only predictable, they're predicted. Scientists all around the world are telling us in no uncertain terms exactly what we can expect if we continue to act as we do now. And that is a catastrophic collision with ecological reality, what one report called a global Somalia. And if we want to avoid that unthinkable future, we have to get really smart really quickly. We have to demand a future which is currently unimaginable. And here's the work order for building that future. We have to imagine and design new models of one planet prosperity. Right now, most of the people in this room probably have what they would call about a 10-planet ecological footprint, meaning if every person on the planet lived as we do, we'd need 10 planets worth of resources and energy. We obviously don't have another 9 planets, so we need to figure out how to provide prosperity that fits within the Earth's limits, right? We need to include every person everywhere. We need to figure out how to spread the tools to share new designs and solutions widely, and we need to rebuild our entire material civilization in about the next 3 decades. So a little something to do in our spare time. What does World Changing do? We're a small NGO. We have a global network. We take donations, I'm required to say. We hunt and share tools, models, and ideas for building a better future. We go all around the world. We have people looking for ideas that could make a big difference. We also have a book, this book. Al Gore wrote the foreword. Stefan Sagmeister designed it, and Earth Day founder Dennis Hayes says of the book, "World Changing might be the most complete, compelling articulation of the possible look and feel and actual operation of a sustainable society ever written." And we didn't even need to pay him to get him to say that. We also have a French version coming out, and there may be some other language editions. What we found is that people are really hungry for a better future. It's been one of the coolest things over the last year has been this sea change, this massive shift in public opinion about issues relating to sustainability, where the debate is really over. There's really only two sides now. There's, you know, people who understand that the Earth has practical ecological limits and we're running up hard against them, and people who are wrong. And that's allowing us to, you know, move forward in a lot of new ways. We're just beginning to scratch the surface of what is technologically possible. You know, for example, we all know of giant windmills, sea-based windmills, but why can't we fly windmills like kites? Or why can't we use spherical solar cells, SVLAR as they're called, to make many, many more surfaces self-powering? Why can't we build buildings that use no outside energy at all? This is BEDZED, the Beddington Zero Energy Development in London, and I actually have been there. It's beautiful. It's gorgeous. It's a really nice place to live, and it is a zero energy development, or pretty close to it. Why can't we build cities that work with natural systems? You know, right now we have, you know, we pay good money for water to come out of the tap, and yet we treat water that falls from the sky as if it was pollution and channel it into sewers. Why can't we use it to grow gardens on our rooftops, for example? If we get innovative enough, we have already the technological capability to design a life which is beautiful and sustainable, which is, as we say, bright and green. Right? This is not something that, while it's still many technical challenges remain, it's not something we can't do. We know we can do it. However, we also need to move very, very quickly. And to move as quickly as we need to change deeply enough, quickly enough, we're going to have to start to think in new ways. One of my favorite examples of how we might think in new ways is Netflix. I'm sure most people in this room are familiar with it. If you think about how we used to rent movies, right? We used to, for most Americans, you'd get in your car, you'd drive to a big box store, right? You'd park in a huge parking lot, walk into a building that's full of lights and, you know, hot lights and HVAC systems and so on and so forth, hunt around, find the movie that you want, hopefully, bring it back, rent it, to take it home, watch it, then drive back to the store and repeat the whole process, right? Well, with Netflix, when you order it online and the mail carrier brings it to your house, the mail carrier is already coming to my house, so that's not an extra trip. It's already coming back again in a couple days, so when I send it back, that's not an extra trip. So really, you're getting the same movie that you wanted to watch, but you're eliminating not only four trips, you know, two trips to and from the video store, but the video store itself. Right? The ecological footprint of the movie that you wanted to watch when it arrives from Netflix is a fraction of the ecological footprint of the movie that you used to watch by driving to Blockbuster or whatever. The point being that there are ways to get the things that we really want, the experiences, the prosperity, the security, the status, without all the baggage that has come with the systems we've currently created, if we think more intelligently. We can dematerialize stuff. We can dematerialize all the extraneous stuff that gets in the way of us having the lives we want, you know, with, you know, with, at currently, very, very high ecological cost, right? So one great thing is compact living in well-designed cities. We know that when you have a well-designed city and you bring things closer together, people's ecological footprints drop because they're sharing the same infrastructure. You're able to be closer to things that you want. You have access by proximity, as they say, right? So you don't necessarily need to drive 30 miles to find something that you might want, as you might in a far-flung suburb. It's close by. You can get it. We're realizing that cities are tools for making your life greener if they're done well. And that's because how you build things matters a lot. Here are maps of two Seattle neighborhoods. The neighborhood on your left is an older, relatively compact, very nice neighborhood called Finney Ridge. And the blue is how far you can walk in 1 mile from the star. On the right is a newer, sort of far-flung, sprawled-out suburb. And again, the blue is how far you can walk in 1 mile. And you see by not using a grid system, by sort of sprawling things out in cul-de-sacs, it actually becomes pretty difficult to get anywhere. And you can imagine which of these two neighborhoods has a lower rate of automobile trips, which of these neighborhoods encourages more driving. At the same time, we're getting better and better at knowing where things are. And my favorite example of this is Zay Frank's If the Earth Were a Sandwich project, which I'm sure many of you are familiar with. But his mission statement here is really, I think, an important document. So let's go ahead and read it. It's, never before have two pieces of bread been simultaneously placed on the ground directly opposite each other on the globe, thus making an Earth sandwich. The fact that the Earth has never been a sandwich is probably why things are so effed up. Now, it's kind of a silly conceit, right? You walk around with a GPS device, you communicate with somebody on the other side of the planet. When you figure out that you're exactly opposite the other person, you put a piece of bread on the ground and you've turned the Earth into a sandwich, right? Who would want to do this, right? Well, it turns out actually a lot of people want to do this. A really disturbing number of people want to make the Earth a sandwich. And this is, it's just simply a fun observation of something that we all know but we take for granted and thus don't fully understand, which is that we're better and better and better at knowing where things are. And when you add that ability to know where things are to the benefits of a well-designed compact space of access by proximity, you get the ability to make cities even more sustainable. So many things are only garbage when they're in the wrong place. Right? When you know where they are, it allows somebody who wants that thing to turn it back from garbage into a resource. Here is a screen capture from a site called Garbage Scout, and you can see that there's a pair of underpants on Bedford Avenue in Brooklyn, and it was left there a mere 15 hours before. And so if you are in the market for a pair of used underpants, you know where to go. Somehow this business model didn't really pan out. But there are others that have done pretty well. There's a program called Waste Match, which lets industrial waste processes like feed each other. There's FreeCycle, where if you have a box of junk you want to get rid of, you can send an email message and people will come to your house and take it away, which is pretty helpful. But perhaps the best example of what happens when you know where things are and where things are is close by because you live in a compact city is car sharing. Car sharing went nowhere for decades, right? It's an idea that's been around for a couple decades now. It used to be really crunchy. You used to have to like sign up ahead of time and send in a sheet filled out like 2 weeks from now I will want a car on these dates, right? But its technology has allowed the experience to change completely, right? So now, if you have a cell phone, you can figure out where the nearest, car is, walk up, use a swipe card, get in, get the key, and drive away. It's pretty easy. And car sharing has real benefits. About half of the energy and most of the materials that will ever be used while you are driving, in the use of your car, are used to create the car, get it to you, and then take it away when you're done with it. Right? So if two people share a car, even if they still drive the same distance, they're using half as much of that initial pool of resources, right? And the more people who use the car, the less their share is, right? So you essentially sort of save enormously on your ecological footprint simply by sharing cars. And how many cars can be taken off the road when you share a car? Well, One company in London found that it was 6-1. More recent studies have found that in compact cities, it can be as many as 20-1. So for every car that's shared, 20 people decide not to have a car, right? You still get to drive when you want to drive. It's pretty convenient, pretty easy. It can save you money, right? But you actually have really reduced the ecological impact of owning a car. It's by far the greenest way to have access to a car. But there's also something even more interesting to me, which is that people who share cars are better drivers. They plan their trips better. If you think about it, if you only have, say, a car for 2 hours on Sunday to run your errands, you're going to be a little more organized. You're going to think about what's close to what. You're going to make lists. And as it turns out, people actually get more done with each trip when they share cars. You don't have the luxury of sort of forgetting things at the store and so on and so forth. And that actually means that people use less gas to get the same stuff done. And so, for example, members of San Francisco's City Car Share saved 1 million gallons of gas in their first. It's a relatively small nonprofit car sharing, and I think it was in their first 6 years they saved 1 million gallons of gas compared to what other people would have used to get the same stuff done. So for some reason, they decided to build a life-size Hummer out of reused styrofoam. Not really sure what that's about, but it's a pretty cool picture. Point being, when you share things, it gets easier to use them more effectively. How many people in this room have power drills? Wow, much more than average. Okay. Excellent. The average power drill gets used for somewhere between 6 and 20 minutes in its entire lifetime. So yours probably get used for 3 to 10 minutes on average. Now, some people really do need drills on a daily basis. They are involved with construction or what have you, and a drill is an essential tool. For most of us, we keep the drill around for years on end, looking for that opportunity to put a hole in the wall, right? And we've made millions and millions and millions of power drills. Somebody just at a talk recently told me that they estimated 200 million power drills have been manufactured in the United States. Or sold in the United States. This is the epitome to me of unsustainable waste, right? Because while there certainly are emotional satisfactions to owning a good power tool, as this child is showing us, we don't really need the drill. What we're looking for is the opportunity, the ability to occasionally make a hole in the wall. What we want is the hole, not the drill. And there are already tool sharing libraries, tool sharing services, tool rental services that are cheap and convenient, and will get us the ability to make that hole in the wall at far less ecological damage. When you start to think of things differently, you can do things differently. One of the things is that when you measure things, you change the way you use them. The Brits found that simply moving the energy meter inside the home drops home energy use by 10 to 12% before anything else happens. So not using any new technology, not insulating the house, just moving the energy meter inside makes you use less energy because you suddenly see what you're using on a daily basis and you go, I probably didn't need to leave that light bulb burning in the basement. And observed flows can be made beautiful. This is a cord that grows more brightly the more energy that flows through it. It probably ought to be switched the other way around, but it's a beautiful idea. Some of the methods of revealing our action can be pretty simple. This is a light switch that says simply, flash floods off. And not all measurements are digital. This is, not all reveal flows need to be constantly revealed. This is an art project which recycles the water used in a home for bathing within the same room that you're bathing. Now, we don't all want like giant plants trying to, use up our shower water, but if you think about that concept of having to deal with the water that you use in your own home on your own property, it sort of reminds you of how much water we waste on a regular basis, right? When you know where things are, it also gets easier to create different relationships between people who make things and people who use things. Why do you need to own your carpet? Interface, a carpet company, will lease you carpet. When you're done with it, they come and pick it up. They'll swap out panels of carpeting that are worn out. and they remanufacture it all. This is another company, and just shows the kind of energy and waste savings that happen when the carpet gets recycled as opposed to thrown away. And obviously, if the company is taking the carpet back, they have a strong incentive to recycle it. We feel no attachment for that little white airplane pillow that we get on the airline. We don't have a moment of separation anxiety, at least I hope we don't. When we're leaving, we don't go, oh, this white pillow, I wish I could take it with me forever, right? It's different than a pillow that, say, our grandmother embroidered or other objects that mean things to us. Why should carpets or dishwashers or drills be any different than that little white pillow? Why can't we separate out the things that we really want to own because they mean something to us as objects and the things that we want to use because they're practical and utilitarian? When we're done with things, companies could take everything back. Here's my cell phone now. I've probably had 10 of these things, right? I assume most people in this room have had a number of electronic devices as well. And you probably know that it's very, very difficult to recycle these things as they are now. And most of them go into landfills. The ones that don't tend to get like sent to China and picked apart by small children for the heavy metals in them, right? If you have to take the cell phone back at the end of its useful life and you are a cell phone producer, you are going to make that cell phone differently. Here is a cell phone that when you put it under high heat, it pops apart. The threads unscrew, it completely disassembles itself, and you can recycle or reuse all of the components. You know, when we start to think that way, we start to imagine the ability, we gain the ability to imagine thinking through the ecological cost of all the stuff that's in our lives. You know, imagine if products came with environmental nutrition labels, right? You know, they told you what kind of pollution's in it, what kind of toxins, how much carbon got used to make it. There's no reason why we can't have that level of knowledge about what's around us and demand a backstory to the products we use that's something that's more in alignment with our values. You know, we all want to be affluent, right? But I think what we want is guilt-free affluence. You know, we don't want to think that our prosperity has come at the cost of, you know, melting the ice caps or forcing six-year-olds to sew our shirts, right? We want things around us that tell better stories. It's becoming easier to make things that tell those better stories. We can design a world without toxic blowback. It's gotten to the point where you can do ecological design comes in flashcards. There's no reason why everything we do ought not to be done better. And when we start to think that way, we start to realize that redesigning everything around us along these lines, creating a civilization which uses no raw material, powers itself with clean energy, recycles all its waste, and generates no toxins, is not impossible. It's something we can do if we think differently, and if we are clever enough, we may actually like the lives we have when we get there far better than the lives we have now. We may be better at delivering the kind of happiness that we all seek. You know? In addition, the kind of changes that are going to be necessary to get from where we are now to that point, right? It's going to be a massive change. It's going to mean retooling everything, right? Reworking all our systems. There's a lot of money to be made there. And, you know, people who are ready to charge ahead on that frontier have the potential to really get enormously, enormously rich. But do we have to then leave behind those of us on this planet who aren't in a position to get incredibly rich off it? We think the answer is no. We think that, in fact, a bright green future can be enjoyed by everyone. That the models we are already creating, right, the models we have created already, are being replicated elsewhere. Right? The technologies we, in rooms like this, invent are the technologies that are taken up by the billions of people around the world. So if we design better systems, if we come up with better models, the tools that will be available for other people to use will be better tools, right? And we're learning already how to share tools more effectively. We're learning, for example, how to unleash the creativity of people who we previously have assumed to be helpless, or victims, or people who are in need of our charity. We're starting to understand that there are ways of working with them as partners. Some innovations that we bring to that world are high-tech solutions, made here for low-tech homes, like the Wiese foot-powered generator, or the one laptop per child machine, or the StarSight, which combines power, light, and wireless connectivity for developing world slums, or distance medicine over handhelds, which allows people in countries where there's a very low percentage of doctors, proportion of doctors, to have access to the kind of medical equipment that will help change people's lives, or the landmine detecting flour, which is one of my favorite things that we ever covered. This is a flour which, in the presence of certain forms of nitrogen, changes, the bloom changes from a white color to a sort of rusty red. And it was figured out that, you know, landmines, and there's lots of them out there, depending on who you believe, there's somewhere between 60 million and 200 million unexploded landmines in the world. Nobody knows where they are. Well, landmines can't be found anymore with a metal detector because they're made mostly out of plastic and so forth. So if you want to find them, you need to be able to sniff them out, in essence, or poke at the ground. A long stick is literally the best current practice. They tweaked this flower to change in the presence of the kind of nitrogens that a decaying explosive emits. So you seed a field with these flowers, and where they come up red, you don't step. You know, I think there's something really beautiful about the idea of using, you know, a 21st century beautiful technology, you know, a genetically engineered flower, to overcome a really awful legacy of the 20th century landmines. Some are very homegrown and low-tech. Pot and pot refrigerator, two pots, a layer of sand, some water, a damp cloth, uses the force of evaporation to lower the temperature of the contents inside, creates essentially an unelectric refrigerator. Some are hybrids of old ideas and new ideas. There are places in the world which are very arid but are foggy at certain times of day, and these are fog catchers, an old technology redone with new materials to literally suck water out of the air, pulls condensation out of the air, creates drinkable water. Some of them are, systems that have been around for a long time that are now being produced effectively on a large scale. This is a rainwater harvesting system in India. So in places where drinking water is hard to come by, capturing the water that falls on your roof is an essential. This is the life straw, which is a tube about this long, and you can put one end in pretty much any source of water, pretty much anywhere, put the other end in your mouth and drink. It's a life-saving technology for people who've found themselves in really disruptive situations. Some are simple, but life-saving. This is Plumpy Nut. One of the cruel ironies of malnutrition is that kids who've been suffering malnutrition lose the desire to eat. At the same time, they can't eat just anything. They need certain kinds of therapeutic foods to get their systems back on track. And the therapeutic foods that have been available traditionally have been these sort of thin gruels and really unpleasant things that you wouldn't want to eat if given the choice. So kids who already don't want to eat get presented with food that is really unappetizing. Well, these folks went out and they asked, what is a food that kids like pretty much everywhere? And they found that peanut butter is something that kids pretty much all over the planet think is yummy. So they've invented a really sweet, therapeutic peanut butter. And kids love it. It's saving lives. It's now being taken up by almost all the big international aid organizations, and it's something that will, over time, probably save millions of kids' lives. It's a brilliant little piece of design. Some of them are just sheer genius. This is the roundabout play pump. In much of the world, if you want water, you still have to pump it out of the ground by hand. This harnesses the energy of children playing to pump the water. Give that a hand. Similarly, carrying water home has been an onerous task that has fallen mostly on women for thousands and thousands and thousands of years. This design team from South Africa had a brilliant sort of insight. Why not make a water barrel that can be rolled by putting a rope through it and dragging it behind? Well, it turns out that when you do that, even kids can haul the water home, and water barrels made this way are cheap. And it really, to me, this array of solutions, and there are many, many, many more like this, really points out something, which is that if we can help people face the immediate crises in their lives, we give them a platform, a springboard from which they can start to create their own futures that are much better. And this is something that is within our capacity to do. It's within our capacity to see that people who are in truly dire situations are raised up into a level of stability, and that people who are in severe poverty get more alternatives. When we give people alternatives, it turns out that they can actually sometimes invent solutions we would never have thought of. There's this idea of leapfrogging, which is very simply the idea of taking up the best available technology rather than taking a historically available technology. So, for example, in Africa, if you want to make a call in much of sub-Saharan Africa, you call on a cell phone. There are 100 million cell phone users in sub-Saharan Africa. And that's simply because there are no landlines in most places, and where they do exist, they're out of date and run down and so forth. And a cell phone tower is a pretty cheap piece of infrastructure, right? So you have people taking up the latest technology to meet an ongoing need, right? You also then give people the ability to do some really innovative things. You give people the ability, for example, farmers in Africa now have the ability to call to the major cities and find out what the market price of their crops should be, so that they're no longer cheated by the middlemen, right? As I mentioned before, distance medicine is allowing people to live through problems that they previously might have died from simply from lack of access to knowledge, right? People are also even using cell phone minutes as a form of currency in places where currency is hard to get their hands on, right? You can trade cell phone minutes and so forth. There's enormous amounts of ingenuity out there if we can find a way to help harness it. And we are getting better at helping. One of my favorite groups is a group called the Acumen Fund, which is a group of social entrepreneurs. And they're producing some really amazing ideas, like malaria prevention nets, this new generation of malaria prevention nets, which is much more effective, and which they're producing in Africa for Africans. So they're creating jobs. They're creating affordable, low-cost malaria nets, you know, and they're helping to stop malaria, or mortgages for squatters, helping people who live in the world's slums, and there's a billion people who live in squatter settlements now. By some estimates, there will be 3 billion by the year 2030. You know, it's a huge thing, and giving people an ability to have some stake in the homes that they live in is a really important thing. They came up with a model for doing that. Or organic food marketing networks in the developing world. There's ways of helping people who are already trying to do something good to do it more effectively. So to sum up, we really have only two choices. We can keep going the same way we have been going and replicate a very flawed pattern out several more billion times, and we know exactly what will happen. We know that it's a ruinous future that we face. Or we can start to try and forge a path to a different kind of future, a future that is bright and green, even if it's currently unimaginable. But we can only build that future, of course, if we begin to imagine it. And that's really, I think, the task that falls on the shoulders of people like the folks in this room, smart people with creative minds. We need to start to think about how we might do things differently. And we learn to imagine that future by moving towards it, by trying to make it, by actively grappling with the realities that underlie it. This book, our book, Stefan Sagmeister, who designed it, really brilliant guy, there's a little secret in it, which is you'll note that it has a slipcover, and the slipcover has little die-cut patterns. You can see the sort of shadow of the patterns on the slide there. You also note that the front of the book is blank. Well, the more you handle this book, the more you read it, the more you leave it around, the more it gets exposed to sunlight and dust and sort of the matter of daily life that happens from using a book well, the more you will see that pattern begin to emerge on the front cover of the book. So the more you use the book, something that was not previously there will begin to appear before your eyes. I think that's a really brilliant little piece of design. To sum up, Paul Hawken said it best. You know, you are brilliant, and the earth is hiring. Thank you very much. So I think we have time for a few questions, yeah? Okay. So if someone wants to ask a question, I can't really see out there very well. So, oh, great. Thanks.
Is this mic? Oh, it is. Hello, everybody. Hi, Alex. I hugged you at about 3 in the morning last night. I don't know if you remember. I have read World Changing. I've seen your book. I've heard you speak here before. And I am 100% converted, except I am an infant when it comes to the knowledge of this sort of thing. So I, like an infant, I need to be led by the hand so I can walk, so I learn to walk before I can run. When I saw The Inconvenient Truth, I left all fired up, ready to do a whole bunch of stuff. I went to climatecrisis.net, and what I saw was buy solar panels. Buy solar panels is a $36,000 procedure. I live in a six-unit building in the middle of a city. It's not as easy as buy solar panels. So I would like to know, is World Changing the kind of resource? Is your book the kind of resource? Where is the kind of resource that takes the average person who doesn't live in the developing world, who lives right here in the United States, who would like to reduce their ecological footprint, and give me a step-by-step-by-step guide to do so? Thank
right.
you.
Thanks for the question. There are a number of resources in the book. We take the reader from literally the stuff of daily life, food and cars and clothes and so forth, all the way through housing and energy and water and so forth. And there's a number of resources we recommend in the book. Many of them are also things you can find on the site by searching. And there are really terrific guides out there, an increasing number of them, that will help you sort of tackle any aspect of your life and make it more sustainable, greener, more equitable, more fair. We tend to have one mantra when it comes to this stuff, which is green your geek. Whatever you're really into, you know, try and figure out how to do that thing better. You know, it's really easy to get overwhelmed trying to change everything in your life, you know, and stay up late at night going, paper, plastic, you know. I mean, it's really easy to, like, get obsessed, and it's not helpful. The Earth doesn't need a bunch of martyrs. The Earth needs a bunch of better ideas. You know, so if you're somebody who really loves to garden, you know, make your garden an ecological refuge. Plant, you know, native plants that are good for birds and butterflies and so forth, and figure out how to capture your rainwater and, you know, stop using pesticides and kill your lawn, you know. If you're somebody who likes doing home repair, like, make your next home repair project really green, you know. If you're somebody who's really into cars, figure out how to, like, convert your car to biodiesel or something, you know. If you're, you know, an entrepreneur, figure out how to take your business carbon neutral. You know, or make your business, better yet, make your business about something that changes the behaviors of other people. You know, I really believe that the best thing out there is people who are really passionate about what they're doing. And we need a lot more people who are passionate about changing the world in a way that they enjoy, not a lot more people who trudge warily to, you know, the organic produce line.
And so, there is a way to do this that is time efficient, so I'm not going to spend a month figuring out how to clean the coils on my refrigerator?
There are some excellent resources recommended in the book in the stuff section.
Excellent. Yeah. Thank you.
Hi. I think you might have just answered my question. I was going to ask you a more personal question about whether or not you become obsessed with this stuff. I live in Los Angeles, and I commute by bike every day. Mm-hmm. Thank you. And then I looked up online my CO2 emissions by flying home to Virginia once a year for Christmas, and I got really depressed because it kind of negates any benefits that I'm doing by biking every day in LA. And I was going to ask you about the obsession factor and how you kind of personally deal with that, but kind of hit. Oh, and also, everybody should ride the pedicabs and not cabs, like taxis, when they're here in town, because they're cheaper and fun and
yeah,
it's bikes.
Sure, so. I'm all for it. Pedicabs, everyone. Yeah, I mean, it's easy to get obsessed. I've spent way too much time obsessing about small things that, you know, haven't necessarily been worth it. I've spent even more time obsessing about big things. I think that you mentioned a thing that's very difficult, which is air travel, because there's no green option. There's no better option. I mean, you can take the train, and it's a little bit better if you have, like, 3 days to get across the country, right? But it's one of the things that I personally feel very conflicted about, because I do a lot of traveling, And I actually think that cheap airfare is one of our civilization's best achievements. You know, I think it's great that you can go to another continent and meet people who are very different and see how they live and have amazing experiences. But flying is a horrible thing to do to the planet. So, you know, we offset at World Changing, and that's the best sort of thing you can do at the moment is reduce the things that you're able to reduce and then offset the rest, right? It's not a perfect solution. There's a lot of problems with offsetting, and it's not something that scales, that's going to scale to the billions of people. But, you know, we're still trying to figure that one out. I think going to the question of biking, I think that actually it has enormous effect, because I think that one of the things that we really need to do is those of us who are, you know, who are committed to this stuff need to model better alternatives for other people, you know? So even though it may be quite unusual to bike across LA, simply by doing that, you're giving some other people ideas of like, maybe I ought to get the bike out of the garage. So bravo.
You mentioned how we want prosperity with a good story behind it. And something that I'm always conflicted by is that I love shopping at Whole Foods and buying organic food. But when I stand there and I read the kind of genre of literature presented to me by egg cartons, I'm deeply troubled because a large part of what's going on there is obfuscation, that I have to really understand that free range means something than all natural and organic means very particular things. And so I'm curious if kind of what you think about that in organic food and how you think that kind of very tailored narrative around products stands in the way of actually improving them, that it just makes us feel better about things that maybe shouldn't.
Well, I think, you know, we have to be always vigilant that we aren't deceiving ourselves by using buzzwords and so forth. But that said, I think that we are actually getting better and need to get much better still at telling the stories of products. We recently reviewed a great project that we came across in India called Background Stories, which is a series of graphic designs for food products that sort of tell the story of what went into the food product and how much sort of, you know, benefit or harm was accrued in the process of that. There's other great projects out there like Fair Tracing, which is a new sort of design project designed to show where your food actually comes from, so that you know that the bottle of wine that you're getting was produced organically in Chile by this person. I think eventually, you know, we want to be able to have that layer of that sort of sense of transparency in all the stuff that surrounds us. There are enormous vested interests against doing that, but I think that we can do that. And I think that the more that story, that more that stories get told, the better we'll get at learning to hear them and see what they're really about.
Thanks.
Sorry.
A little bit of an answer for the first question, as far as the, after watching the movie What to Do, there's another GORE initiative, the Climate Project, theclimateproject.org, in which he's trained 1,000 people. Some here, I know there's others here among us, and we can, in your town, customize a presentation specifically tied to actions, tied to specific local, topic-specific, greening your geek or whatever.
Yeah. Thank you.
Hey, Alex. I was curious, so World Changing has, I think, been hugely influential in bringing these solutions to light, and now that I think a lot of people are buying into this way of thinking, I'm kind of curious what you guys have in store for the future.
Well, a bunch of things. We are launching local blogs around North America to begin with, but also we're going to be launching them also in the UK and India and probably South Africa and perhaps Scandinavia and some other places. And part of that is because many of the solutions that are most interesting out there are particular to a place. They have a global aspect. They have an element which is universal, but the application of that is often very unique and interesting. So we're trying to create opportunities for dialogue around local solutions. In fact, if you live here in Austin, we have one in Austin. We have others around North America. And if you're interested in participating, we'd love to talk with you. Beyond that, what we're really interested in doing is trying to better articulate what the kind of future that we're talking about here might look like. We really need better imaginings of better futures. And so our next projects are going to be more about that. I could go on, but I won't subject you all to that.
Great. This is a shameless response to the first question, and that's to visit greenpeace.org. We have a green living guide online that gives you everyday tips. And we're also going to be sending out an e-card for St. Paddy's Day so you can tell your friends not to just wear green but live it.
Great.
Hi, Alex. Michael Gomez, Austin World Changing.
Hey.
I was hoping you could explain more the concept of offsetting for people in the room that don't know about it, and also a little bit about your idea about handprints, or yeah. Handprinting as opposed to footprinting.
Sure. So the principle behind offsetting is that the actions that we take, especially actions that we take which are which produce negative impacts on climate, can be balanced out by positive actions that other people take on our behalf. So if we're flying in a plane and we produce a whole bunch of carbon to get ourselves to Europe, we can pay somebody else to plant a bunch of trees or to invest in a new wind power station or something like that that will have a beneficial effect equal to the damage we've just done. There are a lot of problems, a lot of challenges. It's a poorly regulated field. It's not a perfect solution. But it is a pretty great way of at least moving in the right direction when you are confronted with a behavior that you have no ability to change. And they're really cheap. They're available. There's a whole bunch of them out there. If you're interested in this subject, we've done a few pieces on offsetting, on world changing, which have produced long, exhaustive debate between people about what's good and bad, and you can go look it up there.
Tara Hunt, we have a business that's sort of based on collaboration. We actually have a co-working space in San Francisco, and we are registering to become a green certified space and encouraging other co-working spaces around the world. But I just had an idea for the conference organizers here. I don't know who fills these cards, these things out, but I figure that a lot of energy is probably wasted on it every year. Why not just have an SMS option for us to vote on the sessions we're in?
Yeah.
Hi, I was wondering if you could offer some big picture thoughts on the role of race, class, and gender analysis in making these kinds of paradigm shifts that you're discussing.
In 30 seconds or less? It's impossible to separate issues of social justice and equity and fairness and democracy and human rights from this larger picture of sustainability. If you check out the book, you'll see that about half the book is actually about questions like, how do you protect people's human rights? How do you create businesses which operate in a fairer, more responsible manner? How do you promote democracy? How do you, use nonviolence to challenge people who are using violence to oppress you? And so forth. I guess the best way that I might put it is that I believe that the problems we see in terms of poverty, the problems we see in terms of oppression, the problems we see in terms of environmental unsustainability are all symptoms of one larger problem, which is that we have screwed up and made some bad decisions and let people who profit enormously from those bad decisions continue with business as usual long after we know that we're not doing the right thing. And I think not only do we not want to try and build a world which is more sustainable but not fair, I don't think we can build a world which is more sustainable but not fair. I think we need to be in this with people all around the world who we need to make altruistic movements, altruistic gestures that help them just as much as we need them to make the same altruistic gestures towards us. We have a lot of things that we can do to help people in China, but we also need them not to burn their coal. They are now the largest emitter of greenhouse gases. We can't beat the climate problem unless we figure out a way to help the Chinese beat their climate problem. So I don't know if that's the answer you're looking for, but I think that The long and the short of it is that it's absolutely integral to building a better world.
We see a lot of computers used around here, and obviously electronics are a big problem in the landfills. Do you know any computer manufacturers that are making large strides in the recycle business?
Well, I wouldn't say large strides, but we've done on the site a number of things about green computers. Most of the efforts so far that I know of are still largely half measures and better theoretical improvements. Right now, this is still pretty much an ecological nightmare. I am hopeful that in the next few years we're going to see some big strides towards making that not the case, but it still is the case now. So one of the best things you can do, by the way, is extend the usable life of your computer for as long as possible. Don't upgrade until you really need to. When you do, give your computer to a nonprofit, which will refurbish it and give it to an NGO or to a school in the developing world or something like that. Use it up, wear it out. Try not to generate more demand for more boxes to the extent that you can.
Hey, Alex. I work for an environmental nonprofit in San Francisco, and therefore I'm in the business of convincing. Usually with the sky is falling, things are bad, do something. And for years it seems like our part of the industry has used negativity to motivate people. And what I love about World Changing is that it's full of solutions, which is very different. And so my question is there still a space in our community and our culture for kind of the doomsday, like this is how bad things are? Or should nonprofits and environmental groups like my own really start focusing more on solutions as opposed to the possible doomsday scenarios that have in the past motivated people to take action?
Well, my personal feeling is that most people have at least an intuitive grasp of how bad things are these days, if they're paying any attention at all. I think it is useful to remind people about the magnitude of the problems we face, especially to have an informed debate about exactly how bad those problems are. But I think we have, those of us who consider ourselves environmentalists, have made some mistakes along the way. And I think that we've done something that's pretty awful to people, which is to hit them over the head with this truly catastrophic information, could be the end of civilization, right? And you're in dire peril, your family's in dire peril, the future could really, really stink, and then leave them with almost nothing meaningful to do. A great example being Inconvenient Truth, right? 90 minutes of, detailed explanation about why the eco-apocalypse is at the door, and then a few solutions jammed in between the credits, right? I think that there's the Edward Abbey quote that the Sierra Club uses it on like every calendar it's ever made, right? Which sentiment without action is the ruin of the soul. But I think that we give people the sentiment that things are horrible, and then provide them with actions that most people know are meaningless. I think everyone knows that recycling your cans is not going to save the planet. But we leave them there on the theory that recycling is a gateway drug and will lead to harder stuff, And I think it's much more interesting, productive, and ethical to suggest to people that they can do something meaningful and that they already know a lot about at least one thing and they can start to change that thing. They can green their geek. So that's what I think we ought to do.
It's great work, and I'm wondering, it seems like sci-fi and the media and the future in this post-apocalyptic world it's always a post-apocalyptic world, So how can we, and kind of what can we do to try to engage the media and change the vision that's presented, not to people in this room, because we may be talking to the choir here, but to the larger society?
Well, I think this is actually a really big problem. I think that, you know, we have, Bucky Fuller, right, the old, you know, early 20th century, you know, inventor of the geodesic dome and the Dymaxion car, mad designer par excellence, right? He made the point that you don't get people to change by criticizing their behavior. Telling people that they're stupid is not a very effective way of actually getting them to motivate. You get people to change by showing them a better alternative that they want more, right? You get them to change by showing them a new model to which they want to defect. And I think that we have a profound lack of better futures around us, a profound lack of visions of what our society might be like, which are enticing and which are things that we want to fight for. I mean, this is my job, and I can tell you that I have seen almost none that I think are compelling. And so, you know, I think that those of us who think seriously about the future have a little bit more of an obligation to start describing how things might be. You know, it's much less fun, though, to think about, you know, what closed-loop manufacturing jobs might be like as compared to, you know, how we're going to fight off the mutant zombies. But, you know, but I think that we need that. We need serious, compelling, dynamic, beautiful visions of where we might be headed.
Hi. My name is Mathilde Pignol, and I work for Frog Design, a product design consultancy. And one of the challenges that we face is we work for clients that, you know, when we present the fact, oh, you know, we really want to try and do a sustainable product, or have you thought about making this product we're going to design sustainable? And there's a lot of resistance to that because our clients want to stay competitive. And if they make something that is sustainable, there is the perception, at least, and maybe the reality, that they're not going to be competitive. And so unless everyone, you know, starts moving in that direction, it's hard for them. Do you have any thoughts or insights?
Everyone is moving in that direction. I mean, that's the great irony here, is that I actually was speaking with some folks who are at a company that makes footwear that most of you have probably heard of. And they actually have some really cool things going on about making their manufacturing cycles more sustainable and coming up with better, you know, a new generation of shoes that's better for the planet and so on and so forth. And they're very reluctant to talk about that because the perception is that somehow people will think that their products are less valuable and their shareholders will be upset and so on and so forth. But we know that, first of all, regulation is already moving very quickly in a lot of fields. There are cars manufactured in the United States that can no longer be sold in some countries because they aren't fuel efficient enough, for example. That trend is just going to accelerate, right? We know that there's going to be, I would bet a large amount of money that we're going to see a global cap and trade system in carbon in the next decade or so, you know? So if you're making things that are carbon inefficient, you are putting yourself at a competitive disadvantage compared to companies that are already investing large amounts of money to move in that direction. And the same thing's true of toxins, same thing's true of raw materials, and there's a public perception shift that's already happening. I think that you could, you know, fairly easily go online and download, you know, 100 or 200 magazine covers about how green is the next big thing, and bring them to your clients and say, do you want to be the company that doesn't get the next big thing? Then keep making your products the way you do. My sense is that there is actually a pretty big shift among companies that are in the know to want to get there.
Hi, Alex. My name is Eric. I do a online environmental documentary film series called Terra. And one thing that I perceive just working with film and scientists is that for a long, long time, the scientific community didn't really have or didn't seem to have a very public voice in terms of airing the sorts of concerns and information that we've seen. Now, that seems to be changing somewhat with climate change, but I still perceive sort of a information gap that the science community has been aware of these problems for such a long time, and yet there's not the public communication in from that field to media outlets and to the public. So I'm wondering if you think there's an emerging place for that voice.
I hope so. I mean, I think we're getting a little bit better. I think American journalism is not very proficient at explaining science to Americans. But I think that maybe is changing. At least I hope it is. So I think we're pretty much out of time here. Thank you very much for coming and listening to me.